Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday around lunchtime to answer questions large and small and explore the world of whatever, just to satisfy my curiosity and hopefully yours. Today, I have with me an author who's going to answer lots of questions for us about the creative process and what it's like to write books. And her name is Karen Cushman. She is the author of 10 middle grade, what used to be called young adult books, novels. Most of them are about girls in early history. Welcome, Karen.
Nice to be here. Thank you, Susan.
It's so nice to have you. And I was reading a little bit of your biography and some of your favorite things, and I started wondering whether you've lived past lives in some of these periods. What attracts you to those periods in history?
Well, first of all, I haven't lived past lives in though, and I wouldn't want to. Too smelly, too dangerous, too hard. So I choose to visit through research, through visiting places. When I started, before I started my first book, I was working for a university in the Museum Studies Department, teaching a class in what is called material culture, which are objects that have a history. And I started researching material culture of children. So I was looking into children's lives in the past and got really interested in what it was like for children at these times when they had most of the time no power and little value. How did they survive? How did they grow up? What were they like? So I started researching more and more, and I thought, I have to make this up. I can't find out. There aren't diaries left of children in, you know, the 14th century. I have to use my research and my imagination to create this the best I can. So that's what I did for the first book.
And what was that first book?
The first book was Catherine Called Birdie. Now, when I was a child, I wrote a lot. I wrote all the time, poems, plays, short stories, jump rope rhymes, anything. But as I grew up, I didn't write anymore. And through college, I stopped writing. I think it was a hard thing, and authors were these fabulous creatures that I could never be like. So I stopped, but I still had a lot of ideas for a story. I grew up, got married, had a child, and all that time I would say to my husband, "Oh, listen to this, I have a great idea for a story." And I'd tell him this idea, and then that would be the end of it. Nothing would happen. So about 1990, maybe, 89, I woke up one morning with a story in my head about a girl who lived a long time ago, who had no power, no value, and was trying to be herself, whatever that was. So I said to him, "Listen to this, I have a great idea for a story." And he said, "You've been saying that for 25 years now, and I've never seen a word written on paper. This time I will not listen. But I'll read it if you'll write it down." So I complained a lot. He's a shrink, just in case you want to know.
An effective one, apparently.
Yes. I argued. I was irritated. But I did it, and I still have what are the first seven notes for Catherine Called Birdie, seven pages of notes. And it changed my life. You know, once words were on paper, once I had made a commitment to this story and to myself, then I saw it through.
And you've written and published another 8
right
since then, you've got another one on the way.
Yes, with an editor.
Yeah, so most of these are about girls, young girls.
They are. I think that it's important for girls to have sort of spunky, feisty role models, and they all are. And I am a girl. So that's what I really knew intimately. When I wrote Will Sparrow's Road, which is the only one I wrote that's about a boy, the first couple drafts were pretty much about a girl in pants. And I had to stop and say, what besides clothing and maybe spitting, you know, or swearing, makes a girl a 14-year-old girl different from a 14-year-old boy and try and create that boy. Luckily, I have my husband as a model. So I was able to do it, but it was an interesting challenge that I couldn't just be myself and speak from myself. I had to filter it and say, you know, what makes this character a boy?
And did you infuse this boy with the same spunky nature? Did he have as much to overcome?
Yes, absolutely. He was a runaway from an abusive home, and he ran away and joined this traveling sort of carnival show, or the equivalent in the 14th century, whatever it was, and met a lot of interesting people, got to know different kinds of people. There was a girl who suffered from hirsutism, who had hair all over her, and she was shown on a stage like some kind of oddity. They were called oddities. And there was a dwarf and a lot of other people. And there were people who were not so straight and good. And he had to cope with all of them and figure out where he belonged and who he belonged with. So that was pretty much that story.
Tell us some more about some of your female characters and the kinds of things. And I believe there are different periods, correct?
They are. There's three medieval books, three Elizabethan books, and so far, three American books.
So what are the distinctions from one period to another? What sorts of obstacles did they have in each of those different periods?
Well, the girls that I chose to write about, I think, had very similar obstacles. Either they had no parents, or abusive parents, or parents, so like in Bertie's case, so different from what she wanted to be that they were, she had to overcome that. But Rodzina is about a Polish orphan girl on the orphan train, which were trains that led from the slums of big cities out west, taking children, hopefully to find them new homes. And some of those turned out well, some of those turned out tragically. Rodzina was okay, but she lost her parents in a fire. She was all alone. She was bigger and louder and more foreign than anybody else on the train, and she had to overcome that. And she had to find just the right people, the right person, as it turns out, to adopt her. That she would otherwise, if she didn't like somebody, she would call a halt to the whole procedure by behaving really weirdly or, you know, doing something. So that was something for her to overcome. The Midwife's Apprentice is about a homeless child sleeping, as the book starts, on a dung heap, longing for a name, a full belly, and a place in the world. So it's sort of similar to what Rodzina went through, but also different.
It sounds like there's a common denominator there of aloneness.
Yes, absolutely.
Or even abandonment.
Yes, aloneness or abandonment or being so different from where you're planted that you have to figure out how to survive like that. And I imagine that that's part of my own story.
Yeah.
Because there it's come out so many times. Yeah. Yeah.
Was your childhood anything like that?
Absolutely not. I had an intact family, loving family. I have a loving brother. We always had food. We lived near Chicago until I was 10 and then moved to California. And that was harder for me because I was not a California girl. I was a Chicago Polish girl in Southern California. And that was a real adjustment. And I think a lot of that has to do with the characters and the situations I choose. And why a lot of my girls are 13 in that age range, which is what I was when we moved to California.
And that's such an impressionable age.
Yes.
Yeah. Where a lot of your fundamental belief systems or characteristics are formed.
Right.
So there was a time in your life then when you were struggling to be you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And is that the message you're trying to get across to your readers?
I think it is in general, yeah.
the struggle to be oneself.
Right, and you have to figure out who you are and what you believe, what you value, what you think is true, you know, what it means to be human in this world. You have to figure that out and then try and hold on to that.
If you were going to write a book about girls today...
I don't think I could. I think I'm so far away, it would be like writing about an Aztec child, practically. Huh. You know, that I'm so far away from the technology, the problems, the issues, the drugs, the early sexualization of kids. All of that is just so foreign to me that I'm not sure I could accurately go there and talk about it. I'm not sure I want to. You know, I really fear for our young people.
That's an ominous note.
Yes.
Because I was thinking about the obstacles to young girls today,
mm-hmm.
Finding out who they are.
Yeah, it's the same obstacle
becoming
in
themselves.
A different kind of world. Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there are even stronger obstacles.
I think there are a lot of obstacles we don't really know about.
Yeah.
You know, something that would send 12-year-olds to commit suicide.
Yes.
I mean,
which isn't that uncommon
right.
these days. Yeah. Did that have anything to do with your moving into fantasy in your 2016 novel, Grayling's Song? Did you start moving away from reality and into fantasy?
No, I had written at that point, I forget, 8 books, because that's my 9th. And I wanted to try something different. And I had this image of a girl looking for her mother and finding her feet rooted into the ground like a tree. There's a curse in that Grayling, who is shy and retiring and quiet and doesn't like to get involved in anything, has to go on a journey, like a hero's journey, to find out what happened to her mother and how to fix it. Yeah, so that was really interesting to write. Fantasy is not my usual genre at all. I don't even read a whole lot of it, though. Now I'm doing more, and there are some really, really fine fantasy books out there that deal with issues beyond dragons and magic.
Oh, yeah, and I think a lot of them deal with issues by using dragons
yes,
and magic.
Yes, right. Yeah.
So what was the difference in the characters that you created for Grayling's Songs mm-hmm. compared to your earlier novels?
Well, Grayling was a different kind of character, but she was more like the early Midwife's Apprentice, that they both had to grow. Actually, so did Francine Green in The Loud Silence of Francine Green, in which the girl is in Catholic school and raised not to speak back, and not to trouble the waters, not to stick out like a nail because you'll get hammered back into place.
Mm.
And it was the late 40s, early 50s, right at that time when the country was very conforming and was very afraid of Joseph McCarthy and all of the other kinds of witch hunts. And there's an issue in her school, a friend, and she has to decide what side she's on and whether she can stand up and do anything about it. And what would happen to her if she did? So it's it's like a microcosm of what was happening in the mm-hmm. world with adults having to stand up. Yeah.
Standing up for yourself. I'm hearing this theme.
Yeah.
Throughout
yeah, no kidding.
All that you're talking about.
Right. Well, I went to Catholic schools all the time too. So
yeah, so did I. Yeah.
Did you? Got a bit repressive when I went in the 50s.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
40s.
It was. Yeah. Yeah. How do your characters form? Do they have lives of their own? I've heard other authors say they come to me fully formed, or how does that work for you?
A little boy once asked me if I thought I channeled my characters, and I said no. You know, I make it up. But they come bit by bit, like the whole story comes bit by bit. When I talk to kids, I discovered that I could use the metaphor of Legos, that one Lego is just a plastic brick. You know, so maybe it's one trait of a character or it's one piece of a setting. But if you take a whole lot of Legos and put them together, you can build a castle or a dragon or a house or a truck or anything you want. And that's the way I think I build the characters, one little tiny piece at a time, and also the setting and the issues, they come. And then you put them together and eventually you have not a castle but a story.
That is fascinating. So you don't start out by saying, I'm going to write a story about a girl in the 14th century.
Well, when I wrote about Birdie, it started out with her complaining that she had to keep an account of her days from her brother, who was a priest. And he wanted her to keep account of what she did every day. And she was grumbling because she didn't want to be in the nobility. She wanted to be a peasant and, you know, work in the fields, or that's what she thought she wanted. So that was sort of the issue. What her character was had to come from that idea that she was fighting against what her brother and her parents wanted her to be. Her father was trying to marry her off for gain, sell her like a cheese, she says. And she didn't want, you know, was determined not to have that happen. So from that situation, a lot of her character traits grew. She had to be feisty. She had to be strong in herself. She had to be willing to take the punishment that was dealt her for speaking up or doing something wrong. So that her character grew like that, piece by piece. Yeah.
You're listening to Real Talk at 101.9 FM KVSHLP Vashon Island, Washington. This is the voice of Vashon. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and I'm here with author Karen Cushman, who's telling us about how she creates characters and how she chooses their time and location. We are fortunate that we can do this thanks to Windermere Real Estate for their support. They make all our community information programming and our emergency alert service possible. So, Karen, who is your favorite character among all those that you've created?
Oh, gee. People always ask me that, and I don't know whether to say
child?
It's like my favorite. You're asking about my favorite child. But I think Lucy Whipple, the Ballad of Lucy Whipple, I think she's the most like me. They had to move from Massachusetts to the California gold country because of her mother's dream of searching for gold. So after her father died, they moved west, and she was unhappy in Lucky Diggins, in this town where she didn't fit in, and life was hard, and all she wanted to do was to go home, back to Massachusetts. And then over the course of the book, found that she was at home. As time went by, it was more and more her home. And when the chance came for her to go home, she said, I am home. She didn't go back to Massachusetts. So I think that I can really relate to her in that aspect. I think The Midwife's Apprentice, whose name I can't even think of, my own character. Oh, my God. I think it starts with an M. I think she's one of my favorite characters because the book came so easily. It was written, edited, and all done in 9 months. And that's my record.
Was that your fastest?
That's my fastest.
What period did The Midwife's Apprentice take?
That was maybe 14th century. That was my second book. That's the one that won the Newbery Medal.
Wow.
Catherine Called Birdie was named a Newbery Honor book, first book. I had no idea how rare that was. And then the second one won the Newbery Medal. And that's the one, 9 months. You know, like to say Catherine Called Birdie took me 50 years to write before I got it down. And The Midwife's Apprentice. Alice, that's
her
name.
Alice was The Midwife's Apprentice.
Alice the Midwife's Apprentice, that's right. Yeah, and so I like that about that book.
Mm-hmm. What did you like best about Alice?
I liked her character and what she had to go through, but I also liked that the book gave me no trouble. It was done and out in 9 months. The first half of the book, which is the first thing I sent to my agent, just came as I was sitting down. It just all came. It was amazing. And I've never had another book like that. They're all a lot more work now.
Are they? So
yeah.
Other than the 50-year first book.
That's right. They don't take quite 50 years anymore, but they are not 9 months anymore.
What's the average? How long does it take?
2 to 4 years, I'd say.
And are you sitting down and writing every single day?
Absolutely not. No.
I'm so glad to hear that.
I'm way too oppositional for that. You know, that was somebody to just sit down and write every day, and I say goodbye. I'm not doing that.
So how do you get in the mood? What do you do?
Well, it depends. Sometimes I sit down and I'm just so tired of doing the laundry and loading the dishwasher and doing all those other things. I have to do something. I have to write something, and then I might just start and see where it goes. I might pull something out of a box that I've started before. I might have something from an editor who wants me to rewrite a whole section. And that's what I find most interesting and the easiest for me is the rewrites, revising.
Oh.
The first draft is pulling teeth. It's very hard for me to do that. And it's partly because, Anne Lamott says, well, no, I won't say it on the air, but she says you have to write really bad first drafts. That just let it out and then you can fix it later. And I can't seem to do that. I need to build on something good and then put something else that's pretty good on that. So it's hard for me to get to that first point.
So when you're doing all those mundane chores, mm-hmm. like loading the dishwasher, mm-hmm. Et cetera, is your head creating these stories and characters?
If I'm involved in a book, absolutely. It goes on all the time. If not, I try. Like the best time for me to get ideas is first thing in the morning, even before I open my eyes, that first early stuff. Oh, but then my husband goes down and gets me a cup of tea and we read the paper in bed and then it's gone. You know, so I really have to have more discipline about that time.
That sounds almost like your subconscious is talking
yeah,
to you.
Yeah, that's absolutely
if you don't
right.
capture it like
right.
a dream.
That's right.
Yeah.
I got to write it down or speak into the phone or something because then they just sort of go away. Yeah.
Did you have a career before you became a writer?
I did. The previous to writing, I was teaching in a museum studies program, which I had gone through already, and then I was hired to be a teacher in the program for people who wanted to be educators in museums or collections managers or administration, those kinds of things, not curators. That is a whole nother story. Mm. At first I was teaching classes like in material culture and other things, and then I got involved with people who were writing their theses because we noticed that the whole class of kids, of girls, women mostly, 15 of them would go into that stage writing their thesis, and then none of them would finish year after year. They'd get jobs and they'd go on and they'd never really finish. So we decided to make it almost like a class, two quarters. You work with me writing your thesis. So as I was on the committee of 15 a year theses, and I'd have to be really quick and find out enough about all these different varied topics and then work with the students going from an idea to a finished product. You know, like they'd say, I want to do something about museums and world peace. And then we have to boil that down to something doable and into steps until you get there. And that was such good preparation for me as a writer. It was great. I did that part for about 6 years.
And they say we teach what we need to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, I thought, wait a minute. That's exactly what I'm doing or want to do because it was pretty early on before I started.
Would it be fair to say that that's where you developed your affection for early history?
I think that, but I was always interested in the Middle Ages. I thought it was colorful, and we'd go to Renaissance fairs, and I'd read books, fictional books like Ellis Peters' Brother Cadfael series, which is fantastic about a monk in the 11th or 12th century. And all of that was kind of a basis. I knew it wasn't a completely foreign land. I had a little bit of ground on which to stand. And then I went from there. Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. And when you write about the Middle Ages, are you what might be called realistic about the conditions of the time?
Yeah, there are fleas and diseases and dirt and sometimes in the background, sexual activity and abuse, all of those things. Public hangings, Bertie goes to a public hanging But because she stands in for me, she didn't like it. But a lot of people, you know, they'd pack up lunches and go to public hangings and cheer and have a good time.
Right up there with the gladiators.
Yes,
and strange entertainment that humans engage in. Yeah.
So I had to make sure I had all of that. Some people, especially then, especially from Texas, criticized Birdie because I used the words piss and privy. And because the person who was going to be the Virgin Mary in the Christmas pageant turned out to be pregnant. And they didn't like that. They didn't like that. And then the Midwife's Apprentice, people complained because it was about childbirth. I figured if there's ever a universal experience, childbirth is it. And so why can't we talk to kids about it?
Ah, so people were objecting that these were subjects you're revealing.
Right.
To young people who really do know. Do you ever talk with groups of your readers?
Like, oh, yes. I haven't done it as much as I've gotten older, but I've gone to a number of conferences with adults who are mostly librarians and teachers of kids, and then I would do a lot of school visits, and we would talk about the books and about them. They mostly wanted to talk about them and their writing, but it was fun.
What did you learn from them that informed your writing?
I'm not sure anything informed my writing, but they sure taught me to look closer. Like on the paperback cover of one of the books, I think it's Catherine Called Birdie. There's a girl with these bright blue eyes on the cover of the book, on the paperback. And this boy said to me, she makes a big deal about having in the book about having gray eyes, and this cover has blue. You know, how did that? I said, I didn't notice that. I had no choice in the cover, but I didn't notice that. But it made me watch what I'm doing with details because these kids are looking.
Yeah.
At all. He noticed this. Other kids have noticed other kinds of things. And they ask questions about anything, like what did women do when they got their period? You know, they want to know this stuff. So I had to go find out all of this stuff. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Yeah. You know, in filmmaking, it's called continuity.
Uh-huh, right.
And that it can throw an audience off, whether they're reading or watching something, if there's a fine detail that isn't logical.
Right. Yeah. You see that on the internet. There are people, I think, watching for that, and then they post them on the internet, all of these mistakes. I'm going to have to learn more about continuity and filmmaking because... speaking of Catherine Called Birdie, Lena Dunham, who was the writer, director, star of Girls and a number of other things, has taken an option on making a film of Catherine Called Birdie. She said it was her favorite book when she was 13, and she's had a dream ever since then of turning it into a movie. So she took an option on it, and we'll see what happens.
My God, that's exciting.
It is exciting. I know it's going to take a lot longer than I think
it
to
does.
Make a movie, even to get a contract and stuff.
But
it's in the works, so I'm very excited about that.
That's fabulous.
Yeah.
Karen Cushman, we're almost out of time, but I noticed on your website you have a list of facts about you.
Okay.
And one of them is that living on Vashon Island is a fantasy that came true for you.
Yes.
When did you start thinking about Vashon? Where were you when you figured this out?
I don't think I thought about Vashon exactly. I thought about living on a beautiful, misty, green island where it rained all the time. And while we lived in the California Bay Area, most of our vacations were up in the Pacific Northwest because we just loved it. So when the time came to leave Berkeley because it was so crowded and expensive, I started looking online at houses and places and... we visited Vashon a couple of times, but it's hard to see what's here when you're just driving on the streets. So we started looking at houses, and I found this house online. And I said, I want that house. And I got it. And now it doesn't rain all the time, but the rest of my fantasy has come true.
Yeah, it's kind of a well-kept secret that it doesn't rain all the time. In fact, folks, we just came out of a drought.
Yeah. No, it's not over yet.
3 years. Yeah, that's right. It's not over yet. People keep saying, oh, I'm so glad it's sunny. And I'm thinking, no.
No,
I want
too.
The rain.
Me too.
We need the green back.
Yes.
That's what we're all about.
Yeah.
Karen Cushman, it's been a delight having you here with me on Real Talk.
Well, good. It's been a delight to be here.
Is there anything we didn't cover or something you'd like our listeners to know about you that we didn't reveal?
nothing. Well, then I'm still working. I haven't published a book since 2016, but there's a new one in the works.
Yes, tell us about that.
The working title is called War and Millie McGonagall, and it's set in Mission Beach, San Diego, right before and after Pearl Harbor. And it's sort of based on my husband's stories about him growing up right there on the beach, on the sand, going barefoot all the time, and the birds and the fish and the clams and everything. And so I really used him a lot in writing this book, and it was a lot of fun to do that. So now it's with an editor, and we'll see what happens.
California in the 40s. I've always wanted to be there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds to me like when it was sort of right at the beginning of the whole Hollywood thing.
That's right, Brown Derby and all of that.
That's right. Yeah. You've been listening to Real Talk here on The Voice of Vashon. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. We're here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime, every Friday at 6, to answer questions large and small. Thanks for listening. And thanks to our theme composer, Luke McQuillan.